Welcome to a new episode of Outside the Panels with your host, Johnny the Machine Hughes.
Welcome everybody and prepared to Outside the Panels. I am your host, Johnny the Machine Hughes. Joining me this time around, we have a couple of writers who have a really cool book coming out and also Kickstarter to talk about. I'm talking to Joe Arby and Eric Peterson of the Bastard Game. Guys, how's it going?
Good.
All right.
Thanks for having us.
You are more than welcome. Yes, this is Space Bastards. It's a new indie book. It's on Kickstarter. It's on Humanoid. You can get it from as well. It's a bit of a change of pace for some things. Who came up with the idea, first of all?
That's Eric. Eric came up with the idea originally.
All right. Okay. Cool.
So yeah, Eric? when I was in middle school, I was just occupying my classes drawing characters and stuff in notebooks, and that's kind of where Davy Proton and some of those characters kind of were initially born. And then when I was in film school, like way later, we were, rather than making the typical film school shorts involving like a drug bust gone wrong or whatever, we were building spaceship sets in my backyard and doing films with a lot of those characters. And that's how I met Joe, through a mutual acquaintance. And eventually it became this. It became Space Bastards Issue 1, co-created with Derek Robertson, doing art duties as well.
Yep. Okay. So that's one of the things we're going to talk about, I guess, quite a lot. The blurb, because it's got Derek Robertson's name linked to it, you get the boys co-creator element there. How was that? Obviously there's a weight of expectation there because people see the boys, and then Joe, what's it like thinking, oh my God, we've got to create something of that ilk, of that standard? Was that a pressure for you, for either of you? Joe?
We just loved his art, you know, and we approached him to do some covers, and he did a fantastic job. That cover you just showed up was one of his first things he did for us. We had another artist on board, and then we kind of went back to him and engaged him and cajoled him into drawing the rest of the book. And there was a point where it set in that, you know, the stuff we've written, you know, people are going to have an expectation, and you know, we really needed to rise to the challenge. And Derek was very patient with us and really helped us out. And I think it worked out well, but it was very daunting to he's been in the business so many years, to come on as new writers and to give him a script that we knew that would be compared to his other work, whether he'd like it or not.
That's an interesting point, because when I talk to a lot of writers, and I always ask the question, kind of like, what sort of writer are you? Are you kind of full script? Are you Marvel method? Are you a bit of a takeover Ted? Because I sometimes think writers are kind of like the custodian of the story, if that makes sense. Because, you know, it's your story. You send it off to an artist, and when it comes back, you're like, well, you know what? Panel one works, panel two doesn't, and all that sort of stuff. How hard was that conversation to have with someone like Derek Robertson, who's been in, you're absolutely right, he's been in the industry for absolute years. You know, he's worked in Marvel, he's worked in DC, he's worked, you know, across the aisles on the indie books. How was that kind of
conversation? He was really patient, and I think he liked the story. He understood overall what we were going for. So, you know, the notes, you know, we would point out things about, you know, continuity or things maybe in future issues, scripts that he hadn't read yet. Mm-hmm. We would point some of those things out, you know, so that we wouldn't box ourselves into a corner with some of the design. But he was just really, he was really good about taking notes and coming back and making changes. It was really, you know, very, very easy. And there were times where he said, you know, this just in the way this is going to read, this is the way readers are going to see it. We need to do it this way. And, you know, he'd plant his heels in on some of the stuff. And mm-hmm. you know, most of the time we took his advice because, you know, he knows what he's doing.
All right. So who got the short straw then? was like Joe or Eric when something wasn't quite right. Who was like, guys, which one of us is going to talk to Derek now?
That's Eric. That's why it was so easy for me. Now, Eric had the relationship with him and could kind of, you know,
okay,
smooth it over.
So, Eric, yeah. you were like the go-to guy.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I kind of came from, I mean, not at all on, like, not even a microscopic piece of Derek's talent, but I came from kind of an artist background as well. And I've mm-hmm. always kind of, I grew up drawing, you know, pencil scratch comics and stuff and studying Scott McCloud and sequential okay. art and all that stuff. So, I think for me, it was like, I always enjoy that sort of conversation. It's never fun to have to go to an artist and be like, hey, we might need to redo something, but handle it carefully and all that. But I mean, like, generally speaking, I think I did have a little bit of an asset in terms of being able to kind of walk through the whys, like, hey, yeah. you know, let's try and problem solve this. We've got an obstacle here we need to solve. So,
yeah, with that our background, it kind of, because writing and art are two separate skills, aren't they? That, you know, there's I like doodling as much as the next person, but I would never ever say that I could draw anything of any great quality. But that said, I kind of know how I want a panel or a page to work, because you've got that kind of visual element to fall right. back on. Whereas pure writers just tend to have to just write and then kind of go with that. Does that make sense? And I don't mean that in a derogatory way. So
yeah, so and you bring up a good point too. So I mean, I think that's kind of another thing that's worked well for me and Derek and Joe and everything as well, is that for the most part, unless there's a continuity issue or unless there's something that, again, like Joe said, something that we know would conflict with later issues, we really try not to redo anything. We try to kind of keep the artist's the artist's direction and everything kind of whole and, mm-hmm. and not, you know, revamp any of that stuff.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. All right, excellent. So who came up? So it's your idea, that's fine. Eric, you work together. How's the writing element then go? Is one of you the plot guy and one of you the dialogue guy, or do you kind of take turns? How's that work?
I think we're both on both. Joe and I tend to volley back and forth a lot. Like we're pretty overzealous outliners. I know other writers who I really admire aren't. You know, I know a lot of writers who like to discover the story when they're actually writing a script and stuff. And Joe and I have always kind of been the opposite, where like the issue one, which is like 44 pages, the outline for that I think is like 12 pages or 14 pages or something of just bullet points and everything. So we try to really kind of uncover everything first and then volley it back and forth between ourselves to kind of make sure, like, you know, is this actually getting the reaction we want out of each other, or does it need more work, you know?
So you act as each other's foils somewhat.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. That's a great way of putting it.
Yeah, cool, excellent. So Joe, which element do you like doing? Do you have a preferred style? Do you prefer dialogue over plotting, or do you just all in?
The dialogue is sort of the last thing that gets worked, and that, you know, that'll actually get changed even at the end, at the lettering stage. Sometimes things uh-huh. don't fit well, or we think of a better way to say it. I you know, all during the day, week after week, if I hear something said, or I'll think of dialogue, and I'll write it down the way something is said, or you know, and just to kind of keep it in mind. I do like writing the dialogue, you know, to help kind of distinguish the characters. But I think my favorite is just in this book, there's just lots of action, quick actions, beats, and that's really the fun of doing this, is really teeing it up for the artist and letting the artist just you know, take it home. That's what I really enjoy.
All right, so we're going to talk a little bit about influences in a little bit. So just a daft question to start us off on this: who is the Batman Beyond fan?
Both of us.
we love the DC animated universe.
Yeah.
As soon as I saw Wayne Powers, I was like, really? Wayne Powers? Really?
There's a funny story there, yeah.
Yeah, there's a story to that. We were working on an antagonist or maybe as an occupant in our universe, and who would serve as a foil or contrast to our guys. And we had a way back early on when we had, even before Derek got involved, we had a rough draft of the issue made, and there was an early fan that, and this guy, you know, responded to us. He was encouraging. He's this guy that lived in, I think, in Texas.
Yeah.
And we had a early Kickstarter. I mean, we were going to put people in the book and have them die in certain ways with certain pledges. But this guy contributed so much. We said, you know what, we'll make you a major character. And we're like, what's your name? And he says, Wayne Powers. His actual name was Wayne Powers. And we thought, we got it. And he said, hey, be careful. That's a yeah. Batman Beyond thing. You know, you have to be careful about Batman Beyond, you know. Yeah. So we named the company something different, and
yeah,
that's the character. But fans of both, fans of Wayne Powers and fans of Batman Beyond, for sure.
Cool. Obviously, the funny thing too about Wayne Powers, the real life Wayne Powers, is that he got when he read issue one, he sent us back a review, and I expected it to be like a page, you know, at most. Yeah. It was like seven pages. Like, he's like, I think in this panel, what you're really going for is, I mean,
it was unbelievable.
Yeah. It was like, I mean, we're so fortunate and happy to have the reviews that we have from the previous week with the release of issue one, but still to this date, like, I mean, he did a critical analysis of issue one, and he had absolutely no reason to, you know.
Obviously, Wayne Powers has a brother called Max, right? That would just be too cool.
Yeah, right.
Too cool. All right, okay, so I was off the beaten track there with a little bit of the Bats Beyond stuff. So there are other influences in there. What influenced you guys when you were kind of creating this? I thought there's a couple of, a couple of obvious ones that I was like, really? Is that, you know, but I'd like to hear it from you guys. What influences did you have on this book?
Or? Like for me, you know, some movie influences would be like Crank and Crank 2, Repo Man, Cannonball Run, you know, non-sci-fi stuff, but that type of pacing, we're influenced by the artists quite a bit. So there, you know, there's a lot of comic influences that are obvious. Erica, I'll let you take the ball there.
I've got a ton. I always kind of stumble on the influences thing because there's a lot. Wayne Powers aside, Bruce Timm and DCAU and Paul Dini and all that has always been a huge influence with me. Strangely enough, even though I don't know if readers will really pick up on it, is The Wire is I think structurally kind of a integral part of Space Bastards. And then, I was gonna say this too, is that this is old. I don't know if it registers so much in the comic, but I think it's definitely part of kind of the ethos of this. But Jackass, like the cast of Jackass, to me, is a big part of Space Bastards. Even back when Joe and I were making the movies, that was kind of like the thing, was like, hey, you know, if we kind of like just constantly think of those guys, Johnny Knoxville and Chris Pontius and all those dudes, whenever we're like filming with these guys or whatever, it kind of makes it funnier. Like it makes the characters, I think that's kind of like part of the thing with Jeff Tremaine's crew that always worked, was it's not necessarily the gag that they're doing or the violence, but it's always like the lovability of them, you know. Yeah, a lot of those, they're like a little troop, like a comic troop, and they don't, you know.
Cool. So there are comic influences in there.
Oh yeah,
I think we can agree the Lobo's in there a little bit, right?
Yeah.
A little bit of Lobo, a little bit of the Boys, because the main protagonist comes a little bit butchered at times, which is fine because it's cool. It's, you know, you want to buy into that vibe, don't you? That whole kind of, so people, if they look at one thing, they're going to see something similar, or the vibe is something similar. So that's really cool. I really like that. And also a little bit of 2000 AD, I thought.
Yeah.
Some of that.
Yeah, you know, 2000 AD, probably, out of everything you've mentioned.
I grew up reading it. And the funny thing too about the Huey and Davey kind of thing too, what's funny about that is that, like, for us, I think it's always been more like an Ed Norton Fight Club thing. And
granted, yeah, I could see that. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Obviously, with Derek's involvement, the Huey comparison is obviously, it's there. But in terms of like conception and all that, I think it came more from the Fight Club Ed, you know, side of things. Yeah.
Now you've mentioned it, I can totally see it, because there is that like switch moment, isn't there?
Halfway
through the first issue, it's just like that click and something happens. So it's, you know, I'm not going to tell you what it is, guys. So, you know, if you want to find out, go buy the book. If
that's thank how you,
John. Thanks,
no, John. No spoilers here, right? No spoilers. So go and buy the damn book. All right. Okay, cool. So You guys have both worked in movies before, yeah? Is that right?
I guess technically. I worked in TV for a long time as my actual occupation, but Joe and I worked in Ghostbusters movies and stuff.
Okay.
I can't call what we did movies. I mean, I'm not going to. We were in the backyard. You know, this is like when you have a band and you just practice in your garage and you tell girls that you have a band.
Yeah, yeah.
It's maybe a slight level above that, but not, you know, that's it, man.
So when you say movies, you meant you two and the mobile phone that was recording, right?
Yeah. I mean, Eric had a legitimate job where he was doing that, but on the weekends, yeah, it was low budget and we were just goofing around. Yeah.
That's the best time, man. Best time. Yeah. So, you guys had mutual friends. How did you two, those mutual friends, how did they get you into comic books then? Have you been comic book fans previously or? Everyone's not in the accent. Cool.
Yeah.
What do you read? What sort of stuff floats your boat at the moment or in the past?
I grew up, strangely enough, like I kind of went through the normal, like, American late 80s, early 90s kid path. Like, Jim Lee and Chris Claremont's X-Men run was coming out when I was in, like, fourth grade. Everybody was buying those collectible cards, you know, the Marvel cards. And
yeah.
I did all that. And then the Stallone Judge Dredd movie came out when I was like 13, and it's not like, I'm not going to say it's a wonderful movie, but when you're 13 years old and you're used to superheroes all the time, it's kind of a wonderful, enticing world. And my grandma worked next door to a comic shop and she asked, you know, I'm going to send you some comics. What comics should I send you? And it was right after I saw the movie. And I said, anything with Judge Dredd, send me Judge Dredd comics. And luckily she didn't read any of them, because I think if she did, I wouldn't have been sense any of that stuff, but I fell in love immediately with 2000 AD. I've been like a lifelong 2000 AD and Vertigo comics fan, like most of my life. Yeah,
Grand's a class. When I was a kid, I was a huge Star Wars fan.
Yeah,
I was around when it first came out. Yes, the gray hair's real. And my Grand, bless her cotton socks, after about hearing me going about Star Wars for God knows how long, she was like, one night I'm going to find out what all this Star Wars thing's about. I was like, okay, what are you watching? Alien. I'm like, whoa, that's not quite the same thing, but you know, there you go, bless it. How about you, Joe? You've always been a comic fan.
I read a lot of comics when I was younger. You know, I'm about 10 years older than Eric, so I was reading, like, I just read pretty normal superhero stuff. Spider-Man, I read the original G.I. Joe and Transformers and the British Transformers when I was younger, and I remember it was the original Secret Wars that got me into it. And then I read all the spinoff and all the attached comics and kind of hung on to characters that I liked at the time. By the time the 90s came, the Clone Saga and all that,
Did you see the news? They're bringing back the Clone Saga for Miles.
Yeah. And I didn't really come back to it. I mean, I read then, like, Killing Joke and Watchmen and some of that stuff, and you know, it was fantastic. But it wasn't part of my regular diet until Eric, and I started talking about this, and then I needed to kind of brush up and read non-superhero material, and then material that featured artists that we were considering. And so I read a lot of and Garth Ennis's stuff, and you know, the Punisher run, whole Punisher run, which was my, just that, and Barracuda, that whole run, it was fantastic. And Destroyer Max Kirkman did, and I kind of came back to it, and we'll do that now. We'll kind of read through books that when we're courting an artist, or we have an artist about to get involved, we'll read through a lot of his stuff to see what does he really do well, what does he look like he enjoys it, what does it look like he really enjoys drawing, and what have people not seen from him before, and we try to write the material to cater to their strengths and to their interests, so that they have fun doing Space Bastards.
Cool, excellent, good shout. Right, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back. We're going to talk a little bit more about your book, how people can get it, the difference between Kickstarter and published, and stuff like that. Is that okay?
Sounds good. Absolutely.
Excellent. Yeah. Right. So for everybody else, you are getting one of our fantastic ads. You never know, guys, if Space Bastard turns out to be a big hit. Maybe you can get in on this action. This is Crisis in the Toyverse from our guy, Bobo. And you can see the interviews and these sessions all on the UCPN. Here you go. Right, so that's Bobo Max Crisis in the Toyverse. Seems to have hit the nerve there, it seems, Eric.
Yeah.
Holy shit, Johnny, you're going to write a real show, man.
Yeah, we've got to go. It's amazing.
We've got
loads of different shows. We have the Finna Crusade, which is about DC. We have No Prize Podcast, which is just about Marvel. We have the great Flipside Focus, which is about indie books. We have the Old Timers Comic Book Show, which is... me and a couple of guys just talking crap about old comics, not just new, like no new stuff. And of course, we have this interview show, the original Outside the Panels. So you know, we have an audience.
Wow,
that's crazy.
I mean, that commercial was way more exciting than what we're doing here. I'm afraid. just play that again. I mean, that was amazing.
I'll tell you what. I won't take offense at that. Thanks, man. Yeah. I'd rather watch that than talk to me. All right. Okay. Right. Okay. So the book, Space Masters, number one, it's out in comic book shops now. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. It came out through Humanoid. How were they to work with?
They're fantastic. I mean, the entire team that we work with, Mark Waid's our publisher, and then Rob Levin's our editor and stuff. And they're wonderful all the way across the team. They've been really fantastic.
Do you find that and this is to both of you, I guess, do you find that the indie market's really opened up over the last, you know, I see like companies like Dynamite and Boom and IDW doing lots of diverse stuff now. Dark Horse has lost a lot of their license and stuff. Do you feel that the indie market's now opened up because you've got AWA, you've got Upshot, you've got all these other different Ahoy Comics are there as well now.
Do you mean in terms of like different publishers and whatnot? Yeah. And like it's not such the big two.
Yeah,
I think so. Though that wasn't really, I think, the main thing that attracted us to Humanoids. I think the big thing that attracted us to Humanoids was just the caliber of content that they have.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, too, once we actually met with them, how much they saw eye to eye with the project. Like it was clear when we talked to them that they understood what we were going for and everything. And not everybody in America necessarily, I think, would do that or see eye to eye with us, you know?
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. Joe, you happy with Humanoids and how they interact with what you're wanting to do?
They've been great. They really understood the book from the very beginning. They jumped on it. You know, I describe them as the honey badger of publishers, of comic book publishers. You know, they're small, they're unkillable, and they don't give a shit. They have all kinds of, you know, strange, transgressive content. You know, they've got giant sharks. They've got John DeFool. They've got historical stuff, erotica. You know, they have a great international reach, and we really needed the marketing and the international distribution, because we knew we would have a lot of people overseas interested in our artists, because most of our artists are from you know the UK, and so we needed a publisher that would understand that, and they really do. They got it. It's fantastic. Even though they're small, it feels like we've got this massive machine behind us, which has been really helpful and really comforting.
Cool. So you started off on Kickstarter, correct?
Correct.
Excellent. How's the pressure of doing a Kickstarter different to the pressure of doing a book for a publisher?
Well, I mean, the Kickstarter, I mean, you know, you're doing everything yourself. I mean, and we made the entire book already. Uh-huh. And we've run a couple of Kickstarters, and then the publisher, you know, we then because of the success of the Kickstarter, we had proof of concept. You know, we had proof that we could execute. We intentionally decided to make an oversized premium format hardcover that we could take to conventions, that we could sell, we could show to people. And so we were able to really show publishers and get the book in front of a lot of people that, you know, normally when it's just an idea, it's hard to do, especially as a new writer. So the Kickstarter opened that door for us. Once the publisher got involved, everything got easier. I mean, we didn't have to. There's negotiation with the publisher, trying to find the right fit and trying to figure out what everybody's role is going to be. Mm-hmm. But there's tremendous pressure, you know, let off when a publisher's involved. Once you've, you know, signed the deal.
It's wonderful to not be an island unto ourselves as well. I mean, one of the things that's really worked out, I think, great for us is that anytime we have a question that normally Joe and I are just kind of pinging ourselves back and forth trying to figure out, we always are now kind of the protocol is like, hey, let's not make this decision just ourselves. Let's ask everybody else who's quite a bit more, you know, experienced and wise, you know, wiser than us. Yeah.
We were banging rocks together for like 7 years until we got the Kickstarter. I mean, until we got the publisher involved.
Okay, cool. And I suppose that it's a good learning curve, isn't it? You know, because you get to see the whole industry, not just one snippet, I guess.
Absolutely.
Yeah, cool. We've talked about yourselves as writers. We've talked about Derek Robertson as the artist. Let's give out some more credits. I think you've got Diego Rodriguez on colors.
Yep.
How I was working with the book. I've got to say, the book looks great. The colors are absolutely... One of the things I've noticed the most about indie books over the last, I don't know, 3 years maybe, is the quality of the production. I mean, I'm not a big Zenoscope fan, as anybody who knows me will know. However, the quality of the book that they put out, the coloring process, is by far the best.
It's awesome. Yeah, they do a great job.
Nobody goes and buys a book just because of the colors, though, right? Yeah. That's why they've got half-naked girls on the front. But
right, it's glaring when it's not done well, though. That's, you know, that's true. Yeah.
So what was it like working with Diego? Was he super psyched with the book? Was he?
Yeah.
Or did he kind of relate more with Derek's point of view? Does he fall under like Derek's kind of purview? Or?
Excuse me. Diego is he's an independent human being that lives in Argentina, but he is like a creative Siamese twin genius of Derek's. If you get Derek and Derek will say, I want Diego, they come together. Like, it's like, you know, fish and chips.
I had that for lunch. That's why I had for lunch. Well done. Fish and chips.
They're inseparable. I mean, you get Derek, then Diego comes in and they have a language between the two of them somehow. And Diego knows, it's like telepathy. They're able to communicate. And Diego makes what Derek's drawing, you know, he ramps it up. He really enjoyed the material. They started working on some Valiant stuff. I think he's signing an exclusive deal with them. And so you can see a lot of his work over there. But he did quite a bit of work for us, including one of the variant covers that's for issue one that's out and our first three or four issues. And he's fantastic. He does a great job. And he's just, we don't really even have to interact with him. It's all between Derek and him. And occasionally we would contact him and he was all in.
Okay. And one of the forgotten people of comic books, although getting a lot of press, I always try and give shout outs. One of my favorite letterers. Yes, I am that bad. I have a favorite letterer. Simon Boland, again, from a lot of Dynamite stuff, I believe he does a lot for. So how was working with Simon? Font wise, do you get a lot of say on that? Or do you just go with the art choice?
You know, Derek had recommended him and Simon's wonderful to work with. I think he has a real penchant for just clean lettering and making everything really clear and and not confusing, you know, scenarios that could otherwise be pretty confused, you know, pretty complicated. Yeah, he's wonderful to work with.
I get your point, because there's that bit where like the parcel gets passed from pillar to post to pillar to post, and there's the little message that comes up saying parcel transfers or what, and it's like there's a scene. I'm not gonna spoil it, but it gets a little chaotic. So you know, trying to keep track of all the who's got what and where they've said it, you know, I read it, and I know it's supposed to be like super violent and super gory. Well, maybe not gory, but super violent. But I had a stupid grin on my face because I just saw the comedy of the moment. You know, this little computer voice going, parcel transferred.
Yeah.
And people like, Wow. That level of, I guess, like you say, the Jackass element where it's kind of like that whole, like, you're surprised by what's on the screen, but you can't help but smile. So, you know, very good. Very good. Okay, cool. So, do you have other Kickstarters coming in for future issues or?
We do. So we actually, through Humanoids, were able to do something that's pretty unique. And obviously, like, we have the monthly issues, and that's a wonderful way to pick it up for people that like reading monthly, you know, like reading comics that way. At the same time, we have these, like, director's cut hardcovers, you know, that we're doing. Kind of in the vein, I mean, that's how it actually started originally before Humanoids as well. So we're allowed to kind of continue doing those. And those actually directly fund us doing future issues of Space Bastards, like year two and beyond, which obviously, you know, Joe and I really want to do. It's also kind of cool, too, because the story is told a little bit differently. I don't want to give away spoilers, but I do think that people that read the story in the monthly periodicals do get a little bit of a different experience than those that are actually reading it in the hardcovers. Not better or worse. It's just two totally different ways.
There you go. That's interesting.
And Joe and I have kind of, again, it's really kind of weird and unique. Joe and I kind of pretty methodically plotted out that experience for both different types of people. So
when you do a issues that come out monthly, you know, you don't, there's commercial viability. It's hard for an American audience anyway to switch from Derek Robertson to Simon Bisley. You know, you don't want to switch artists, you know, rapidly, you know, or you know, you want to have nice long runs with the same artist and consistency. But with the hardcovers, you know, on Kickstarter, we've interspersed the artist and put the story together in kind of a more nonlinear, maybe slightly less accessible fashion, so that it's read in the way we think the story is best presented. And so it's not just the difference between binge watching or watching it, you know, or reading, binge reading and or reading one issue a month. It's also it's been reordered, and at the end, both people will get the same story, but you get there differently. So it's almost like watching the Star Wars movies in release order versus episode order. You know, there's a lot of different ways to do it, and your experience of the whole saga would be different. And we're hoping that you know, there's gonna be a certain kind of viewer, a certain kind of reader that will enjoy the hardcovers, and then most people will probably get it through, you know, through Humanoids and a comic shop.
It's interesting because if I'd watched Star Wars episodes 1 through 3 first, I don't think I'd sit down for 4 through 6. That's a whole different
argument there. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I'm not even going 7 through 9. Let's not even talk about that. All right. Okay. So if you think
it's a podcast in itself, right?
Yeah. Tell me about it. I'd lose viewers on that one. What was I going to say? Yeah, so you raised an interesting point, because I am very much, I like buying comics. I like buying the 22 pages or whatever. I like that's my thing. I think sometimes when I buy trade paperbacks, which I sometimes have to do for like the expensive issues, because, you know, this gig doesn't pay that much. When I'm trying to read it, it's like you can't see this because of the spine of the book. You can't get into it. You have to really like crack it to get into like the sometimes word boxes are dropped off and stuff. And I know some people love trades, some people love graphic novels, and some people love digital, you know. So as long as you're kind of covering your bases on that, you know.
Well, I think it's kind of a cover your bases strategy, but also to the hardcovers, I'm trying to figure out the right way to say this without spoiling
a bookshelf.
They do, yeah, that's for sure. But like, Space Masters is really unique in the way that it can really be told two different ways, and also because of the nature of the cast, mm-hmm. it also can be told kind of just in a really unique fashion as well. It's kind of like if you were to watch like Pulp Fiction the way that you watch it in, you know,
yeah,
in movies yeah. versus like actually watching it chronologically or something like that. Yeah,
I get it, because with the floppies, with the comic books, you've got to have like that cliffhanger.
There's a format that we
Right, 22 pages, stop. 22 pages, right. stop. 22 pages. Yeah, whereas the graphic, you can say, right, we've got this theme, we've got this idea, we don't have to stop, we can just go for it. And then the stop is at the end of the book, you know. And fair enough, there's going to be peaks and troughs through the storytelling, but, you know, the overall flow, you know. And, you know, I agree with that. I think there's value in both. In kind of both, and as you say, it's a different experience. So, you know, you never know. People who buy the floppies might go and buy the hardcover as well.
I hope. Yeah, I mean, that would be wonderful. Yeah. I do hope someday to have the wonderful opportunity to sit in a room with like a fan that has read all the monthlies and then a fan who has read all the hardcovers, and just like see them talk and just kind of it would be wonderful for me to just hear about the difference in experience, you know.
You can always ask Wayne Powers and his brother Max again, I suppose.
You can get him to do it, yeah.
Yeah, that wouldn't be a short conversation if he's written 7 pages of a review. Oh, yeah. That's like book out a hotel suite and you're there for the weekend. Sorry, I don't know this guy. You're a good guy. I'm really just saying.
He's a great guy.
He's awesome. Yeah, he's really, he was a huge inspiration for us early on because we were just creating this thing. You know, by ourselves, and then somebody goes, "I get this, and I understand this, and I'm a question about this, and question," and you're like, "Oh my gosh!" Like we're communicating to somebody. Somebody's actually receiving what we're sending out. You know,
cool. So, how many issues are in this first run? Is it ongoing? Or do you have a set limit?
It's ongoing.
Yeah, we have about 15 issues done so far. Again, more weird, unorthodox ways to handle comic books. But yeah, rather than wait and see if people actually liked issue one, we just went ahead and made 15 of them just to start. Yeah.
I applaud that. I absolutely applaud that. The amount of times I hear big two companies saying the book's going to ship late because something hasn't been done or something hasn't been finished. I think, well, how can that happen? You know that book was on the schedule.
You know, it scares us to death. I mean, like we're pretty diligent in terms of that kind of. I think like the fan, like we're fans of our own book. I know that sounds maybe it's not meant out of arrogance or anything like that, but we are. We're fans of our own book, so I think we're kind of always thinking about that sort of relationship that a reader has with it, and to start and stop, I think, is always kind of a, you know, that's not ideal.
I mean, there are independent companies out there that love that miniseries style storytelling. Yeah. People like Dark Horse, for example. Pretty much, the kings of that. They started that whole, right, we're going to do 4 issues, then we're going to come back a year later, do another 4 issues. And that's all well and good if you've got, like, a huge property to back you up, like the Star Wars Dark Empire stuff or the Aliens versus Predator stuff. But then if you haven't got that sort of weight of major icon, itch, if that's the word, then you run the risk of being off the shelf too long and somebody else taking your space for the next... Yeah. The next book down the line. So, you know, I think you've nailed it. I think it's a good idea. You know,
I think you're right. I mean, I think there's like that pragmatic side of it. And then there's like this weird other Joe and Eric side of it where we kind of look at it like we're showing a piece of art or showing like an exhibit or something. And for us, it's kind of like, we wouldn't open up the exhibit if the exhibit was like halfway finished. You know what I mean? You'd want that person to have an experience, you know?
You know, that's so refreshing to hear. So refreshing. Because, you know, the amount of books that ship late. From big publishers. Yes, I'm looking at you, Doomsday Clock. Yes.
I haven't brought myself to it yet. I'm a diehard Watchmen fan and I haven't Doomsday Clocked yet. I watched the show. I love the show.
I'm looking at it. Where is it? It's over there. No, it's over that bookcase. Yes, I have it. I've read it once.
Oh, all right.
Whereas I read The Watchmen maybe two times a year.
I read it like that, Sandman, all the stuff, you know, like Transmetropolitan especially. Yeah. Like I'd go in a cycle. Like every year, like every 2 years, I'll be like, it's time to like go back through Saga of Swamp Thing or whatever.
I've got a book of that as well. Yeah. Kicking around. So I tend to, if we go on vacation, I have my go-to books. Like I'll take The Dark Knight Returns. I'll take Year One because they're my favorite Batman books. And then I'll take something a little bit off the wall just to kind of like surprise me, you know. But I've never gone back. I've never gone back on the Doomsday Clock.
Is there really anything in Batman as excellent as Batman Year One?
See, I'm with you on it. People talk to me about Dark Knight Returns being the best Batman. It's bollocks.
It's not bollocks. I mean, like, Dark Knight Returns is amazing, but like Batman Year One, I mean, I read that religiously, like you, and it's like, dude, that is a masterpiece. You know,
perfect. There's not one bad piece of writing in it. No. Not one piece, you know, not at all. You know, and you look at Dark Knight Returns, as much as it's good fun, it's a little bit too satirical for its own good now. With what's going on recently, it's a little bit too like, it's like going back and trying to watch The West Wing.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, I think.
Like, I love The West Wing, just so everyone knows.
Dark Knight, I mean, it's like, it has an agenda, you know, like it had to get something across. Whereas Batman Year One is just a pulp, like it's just there to do its job, you know?
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, I don't read The Killing Joke that often because it disturbs me and it's supposed to disturb me. So when Alan Moore and Brian Bolland did that to disturb people, it still disturbs me. I don't think I've read it. I've got a hard copy of it somewhere. I don't think I've read it in the last 3 years. I'm not saying it's not great. It is great, but it disturbs me. So
sure. Oh, yeah.
It's what it's supposed to do, right? All right. yes, we still play the comics. So if you guys were given an opportunity to work on a Big Two book, we'll go with Joe first. Joe.
Punisher.
You're a Punisher.
For Jonah Hex and for DC, Jonah Hex or Punisher.
Yeah, didn't something come out this week about the Punisher saying that there's no place in the it should be cancelled from Marvel because of his gun tooting?
These guys wear a Punisher, you know. You get rid of the Beatles because of Helter Skelter. I mean, you know, think about all the people that read Punisher that didn't attack the White House. It's kind of a crazy argument, I think.
Hey, man, yeah, appreciate the converted for me. I live near Middlesbrough in the northeast of England. And back in the 80s, some guy walked into a school, and we don't have a lot of gun crime, but he like shot loads of kids. And the newspaper, Sunday newspapers, came out with Gun Maniac reads violent Hulk comics. And like started this whole like diatribe against violent comics. I'm like, that's all well and good, but I don't think I've ever seen the Hulk carry a gun. So he doesn't say Hulk shoot, does he? No, he doesn't. He says Hulk smash. That's how it works.
It's a big thing, like every like 8 years or something in America, there will be some violent act that they blame on video games or something. Like with my age group, it was like Columbine, and then you know those guys played Doom. Those guys played Doom and Quake, so Doom and Quake's got to be the culprit here. You know.
Well, I've just leveled up on Madden. So I'm playing a harder level on my PlayStation, and it's pissing me off. So, if I go batshit crazy, I want it said in the newspapers that, you know, the machines, Miami Dolphins, lost again to Buffalo and sent them over the edge. Jonah Hex and the Punisher. That's a good shout. I like that. That sounds like a great crossover event, that one. I like that. Eric?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard. I would love at some point, I mean, like, I'm in love with, like, certain Marvel and DC comics for sure. Batman's a big one for me. Uh-huh. Conan, I guess I can say that now, but I would feel weird trespassing on, like, Robert E. Howard's stuff. I have all these caveats. I mean, that's where it becomes a problem for me. I would love to do an Iron Man story if somehow it was, like, an Elseworlds thing or, like, something that was kind of tied off. I love that stuff. Like, Robert Kirkman did this Destroyer Max miniseries, like, it was a while ago, like probably over a decade ago, but like that's wonderful because it's kind of like it can't be touched, you know, like it doesn't really get, you know, nothing in there is going to get rewritten or like retconned or anything like that, you know.
Cool. Excellent. There you go. Yeah. I'd be interested to see. I mean, Conan's had a bit of a resurgence, hasn't he? He's joined the Avengers and everything now.
Is he actually? I didn't know that.
Yeah, there's a book. Yeah, there's a book called Savage Avengers, and it's kind of him, Elektra, Venom's in there. So,
wow. There
joys of being a nerd like me, I guess. All right, guys, where can people get the book? Where can people get the book? From the local comic book shop, yes. Where can you get them digitally? Is that on Comixology?
Yeah, it's on Comixology as well. Yeah.
Yeah, cool. And the Kickstarter starts on, it will be
Monday the 18th, so January 18th, which I think, you know, yeah, could be in the past. Who knows? But definitely buy Space Masters every month. There's a lot of exclusive goodies in the single issues, and there's a lot of exclusive goodies in the hardcovers as well. So I would always recommend, if you liked issue one or something, then it's worth checking out both and kind of seeing, you know, what you're missing, because it is, we're kind of painting a whole tableau here. But yeah,
I have to say that I thoroughly enjoyed the book.
Thanks.
I read it, and I read it, and I expected, I don't know why I expected, to be fair, but I started reading it. I was like, oh, some 2008. I laughed at the Wayne Powers bit, Batman Beyond. And then when the humor started, I was like, you know, the little voice recorder and stuff. And that moment where Davey has his coming out moment, as it were, I was like, yeah, well done, well done. Very interested to see how it goes, definitely. So
thank you so much. That's great.
Thank you. That's a good book. Credit where credit is due. Well done. All right, guys. There you go. That's it for another Outside the Panels. Thanks to Joe and Eric for taking the time out of their busy schedules to come and talk to us about their fantastic book. It is available now in comic book shops. Don't forget to check out the Kickstarter for all the hardcover information in there. You heard it from them. Exclusive stuff's in there. So go and enjoy that. All right. All that's left for me to say is don't forget to check out the UCPN for all your favorite shows, including the Definitive Crusade, No Price Podcast, and of course, Crisis and Toyverse, which, you know, they've just blown everyone's socks off on the advert. Well,
it's amazing.
All right. So this is Johnny the Machine Hughes saying, see ya.